Does anyone have a question or anything to say? Please feel free now or anytime. Also, if you don't understand a word or can't hear or whatever, it can be so helpful for everyone if you ask me to repeat or say it in another way or whatever. Also, just if you disagree, so not just to clarify, but you might understand but disagree, feel free. So really big welcome, whether you've already been here for a week or more, or you've just arrived. Already in the last 24 hours or so, we've had so many things happen. It can be a kind of reminder of, with a forest fire, and then suddenly it was raining, and then it was hot, and the monkeys came, and so on. Now the party is starting up down there. Who knows? We talked a lot in the last week about recovering our own natural way of connecting and growing wisdom, growing contact with aliveness that brings transformation and insight. And so I'd like to continue that dialogue and investigation. Can you hear okay? Can you hear okay? Yeah? Can you hear? Also, we're experimenting with some translation to Hebrew there, so let us know if you want to join it or if it's disturbing you. We'll try to find the right way to fit it in. So in the last few days, I mentioned a few times how challenging it can be to feel our natural way, let's say our natural way of meditation that happened maybe as a child, without any formal instruction, just naturally happen. Or moments that of natural ease just coming up, that because I'm not there doing it, exactly because I'm not there doing it and remembering it, I'm so in the experience intimately, there's not the same kind of memory. And so it's easy to lose track of the fact that those moments of kind of spaciousness and ease happen. So sometimes it's just a matter of finding that something fits so well we can barely feel it. But there is something that's fitting, that's really appropriate in our own inner language, very supportive, etc. But I don't want it to sound like it's just trying to find what doesn't hassle us. We're not just looking for support that is hard to feel because it fits so well and it's so lovely and all that. Gautam Buddha gave a metaphor for support, for what's helpful. It's kind of a funny one. He said, sometimes what's helpful is really hard to take. And the example, the metaphor is someone who has jaundice, so that's when the liver is in trouble and the eyes are yellow, the skin is yellow. And it gives us a glimpse of the culture of the time, that what was considered healing at the time, maybe still today in Ayurveda. But he said, if a person came who had jaundice, and someone would come to that person and say, if you want, you can take this, It's urine, so pee, with some herbs mixed in. And it's going to smell and look and taste really terrible. Take it if you want. And if in the story, the way that Gautam gives the teaching, if the person would drink that, it would be in the moment. It would taste and smell and look terrible. But having had it, the person would be well. So that's that metaphor. And then also, sometimes, someone would have belly problems. And they might come and someone would say, if you want, you can take this. This is yogurt with brown sugar and honey and ghee mixed in. And you can take it if you want. And it's going to look and smell and taste wonderful. And you're going to feel better. Take it if you want. So it can come in many ways. I remember when I first came to India, somehow it had happened that I had read a story of an American man coming to India, finding his teacher. And somehow I knew that's what I wanted. Contact with teachings, whatever way, whether the teaching source would be inside me or outside me, but that's why I came to India. Am I going too fast? I just realized. How's it going for the translation? It's okay? Okay. You're awesome. And so I had quite some months to prepare in my imagination how my teacher was going to be. First of all, she was going to be a she. Most of all, she was going to be a she. And he wasn't. Neither he nor he nor he was a she. And each in his different way, very much not she. So especially, we can talk about one of my main teachers, Punjaji, Papaji we called him, who his first job was working in the army. And then he went from the army to mining, and meanwhile collected tattoos. And still in his 80s, sometimes he would, as if he needed help to stand up and walk to his room from the dining room. But his grip on whoever was helping him, sometimes for fun, he would bring them to the ground. So sometimes we might be surprised or not like the package that our support comes in. And sometimes the very fact that the package of the teaching, the way it comes in conflict with my imagined version, is a big part of the teaching itself. It's not so much about what I like, and not much at all about what I expect. And that can sound sort of easy. Yeah, okay, of course. But if we take that really deeper, then we're going to be in a good space with a more open mind to really be able to hear what we need to hear. I don't mean only from me, but in life, and especially inside ourselves. We'll be able to hear what we need to hear from inside. I had a small realization today that for me was kind of a major breakthrough in my understanding of the teachings of Gautam Buddha. I think it's pretty much my very favorite story from his life and from all of his teachings. From his life, definitely it's my favorite event of his life. And even from all those teachings that I have read of his 8 decades. My favorite part is when he gives up. So I'd like to tell this story that some of you know very well, and you've heard me tell it many times because I love it so well. But today I heard it in a different way. So many of you would have heard that, as the story goes, Gautam was born as a prince. And his parents, out of fear that he would go to meditate in the cave, tried to make him happy with all the good things of life. And as we talked about last week, that wherever we make a boundary, then that lack of ventilation eventually asks the rebel in us to break out and get free of boundary, to come back to our natural experience of boundarylessness. And so, of course, he did break out of the palace, and from there, by seeing what his parents had been hiding from him, so the word most associated with Gautam Buddha, suffering. Suffering for Buddha was fantastic because it brought him alive. It had been what he'd been missing, that missing piece. And so he's known as the teacher of suffering, but what he said is, I'm teacher of suffering and the end of suffering. And even that, because he loved suffering because it helped him wake up, even that is, he's stating it in reverse, and actually his path wasn't just suffering and the end of suffering, but his path was through joy and pleasure, but a different kind. At the time, what was taught was trying to get special states through pain and suffering. So adding to what's already bad and making it worse, and bearing that so that the mind would get sharper and clearer. And so he heard the teachings at the time, and he got good at them, he got better than his own teachers. And then he realized it wasn't helping him at all. So now we get to the part of the story that's more interesting to me. First of all, that realization that he'd spent his 6 years of heavy duty practice and had received no help. And he was able to be that honest, zero help. He was able to be that honest, zero help from doing my best with a practice that didn't fit. And instead of taking that kind of personally and just crashing, and blaming himself or his teachers or the world or whatever. At least what got recorded. Maybe he did have a breakdown. That probably would get edited out along the 300 years before it was written down. But in the way the story is told, he just thinks, that didn't work. Maybe there's another way. And then, as many of you know, a memory came of a time in his childhood under a tree that he felt happy for no reason. And he realized maybe that's the way. And he felt afraid of that pleasure, he says. So when you feel afraid of that pleasure, which you will sometime, you have good company of Gautam there. That pleasure that comes for no reason, that's not about me getting what I want or getting rid of what I don't want, just life happening, a total gift, bigger than what I thought I was. Whoa. Do I really, can I bear that boundarylessness? And fear comes, just like it did with Gautam. And then just simply, okay, of course fear comes, and this is the way. So for me already, just that story told like that was something that I was missing all along the many years of practice. Why wasn't this one of the pictures that's painted on the temples with the birth and the enlightenment and the death? To me, that it's the most important moment of his life, because once he's on his path, he's going to get there. Once he's found his way, that's the realization, that's the discovery. That's the victory. But what I realized today is that that discovery wasn't about the happiness that came from nowhere. In the Buddhist tradition, it's called the first jhana. It's not actually the first step of meditation, but it's the first step of, let's say, deeper meditation. And even then, just so you know, there's still thinking in the mind. So don't think it's something that is far from your experience. Almost for sure, we've all experienced the first jhana naturally. Probably we might not remember it because we weren't there recording. It seems to me that it's only someone who has a certain kind of confidence or a certain kind of mind that's able to remember those experiences, but I'm pretty sure we've all had it. Anyway, the first jhana, this happiness that comes for no reason, not because of my programming. I'm not activated to happiness. I'm not triggered into happiness. I kind of fall into it. It's a given. And it feels good in the body and the mind. That's something that had been practiced for thousands of years, they say. But it certainly long before Gotama was born. And that's exactly what his first teachers taught him. They taught him first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, immaterial realms. And that's exactly what he found was not good enough. And then he went to more severe practices, and that also didn't help. So the first jhana was nothing new to him. The experience of happiness that's not caused by the program was something he knew very well, better than anyone that he knew. And so if that's not the realization, if that's not, then what's interesting? What happened? Why was that a turning point for him? Why was that actually the beginning of his own organic way unfolding?
John,
yes.
Can you just clarify?
Yeah.
Are you saying that did the first jhana just arise spontaneously?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
And that's the thing.
Yeah.
I think that's what he realized.
Yeah.
Because the memory of being a child, that same meditative state came by itself.
Yeah.
I think that is what his discovery was. Okay. There's no need to push myself, to shape my mind, to twist myself to get that. That's a natural gift of life. And how different it is to let that energy come organically and follow it that way rather than by me doing it.
Yeah.
That's what I think. What do you think? Oh, Jacques. I think it's the shark. I was like, which shark?
Yeah, the shark.
So I'll just say, for those who've just come, last week I was reading a lot the experience of a French man writing about his childhood, Jacques Lucieron. And he had an accident where he became blind, completely blind. And a few days after that, he found a way to see. From an inner light, he could see objects that otherwise we would say were outside of him. And through his experiments, what he found, this is a true story, a 20th century story. He even, it turns out, later moved to the United States because of the terrible rules in the post-World War II France against people with so-called disabilities. he moved and was a professor of a friend of mine's sister. This is a real person who was blind but could see, literally see. And through his experiments, he found that he could see best when he left room for even the literal objects, he left room for them to come to him instead of going out to get them. And this is such a good practice and such a good mode for our meditative experiencing, that we notice when we're reaching out, trying to grab the breath, and then we start to realize, I'm not even grabbing the breath, I'm grabbing my imagined breath, my expected breath. And then that we realize how silly that is and how unfruitful and unjuicy, and we rest back and notice that breathing is happening and directly experiencing, directly feeling breathing is happening, both by themselves, not two. So that's sort of partly to bring those who were not here last week into the flow of our conversation. And I'd just like to close with a poem by Wendell Berry, who is a US poet who's still living. He's also a farmer and activist. He loves nature, and he moved from the city. He was a kind of cutting edge poet with some of the more famous 60s poets. And then he went home to the countryside to farm. And on his day off in the week, he would go for walks in the woods. He would take a break from the work of farming. And that taking that Sabbath day, that day of rest, came to have a meaning for him that's much like what we're doing here. Of finding that way of, by receiving experience, letting experience be received, letting that direct contact absorb or erase our sense of distance from our experience. So the sense of me watching starts to dissolve, and there's just experiencing. The pressure in us, that habit of pressure that makes a sense of me and the world, starts to fall apart. Just so simply. So this is a poem from one of his days off. So one of his explorations of meditation through deep rest on a walk. So the frog, and I'll maybe go through slowly explaining the words first. So the frog with lichened back and golden thigh. So lichen is one of those things that grows on the trees, not the moss, but it's usually more very white or gray, and it sticks closer to the skin. It's not so fluffy as moss. Do you know what that is? Yeah? Sandra? Yeah? Okay, good. Can you say it in French? I would love to hear it.
I'm not sure.
Oh, okay. Okay. So the frog with lichened back and golden thigh. Thigh is this. And frogs have those amazing thighs. So the frog, don't they? With lichened back and golden thigh, sits still, almost invisible, on leafed and lichened stem. Invisibility, its sign of being at home, there in its given place, and well. So does that make sense so far? I'll maybe read it again once I've gotten through the whole poem, but the English, etc. Does it make sense? Is there any question about just the meaning of the words rather than what it might point to? Okay. Which one?
So the frog is sitting on a leaf, maybe?
Okay, I'll just read that paragraph, that stanza again. The frog with lichened back and golden thigh sits still, almost invisible. On leafed and lichened stem, invisibility, its sign of being at home. There in its given place. And well. So can I go, how is it? Sometimes translating poetry is just a head cracker. Is it okay? Okay. So then he goes on. The warbler, which is a kind of bird, I think it's a really small one. Does anyone know?
Yeah. Yeah, an extremely large family of quite small.
A very large family of very small birds.
Quite small birds. Yeah.
Okay.
Sometimes very small.
Generally difficult to distinguish between.
Yeah.
So the warbler, one of the many, the warbler with its quivering, striped throat. Quivering is shaking. Yeah? The warbler with its quivering, striped throat would live almost beyond my sight. Almost beyond belief. But for its double note, meaning the music. Among high leaves, a leaf, at ease, at home, in air and light. Shall I go through it again? You got it? Oh. And I, through woods and fields, through fallen days, am passing to where I belong, at home, at ease, and well. In Sabbaths of this place, so in deep resting of this place, almost invisible, toward which I go from song to song. Shall I back up? That's the end. Where shall I start again? You're good. Wow, okay. Shabbat. Sabbath. He uses Sabbath. These are all called Sabbath poems. But he goes to the woods instead of the church or wherever.
Can you read it through?
Definitely. Thank you for asking. The frog with lichened back and golden thigh sits still, almost invisible, on leafed and lichened stem. Invisibility, its sign of being at home, there in its given place and well. The warbler, with its quivering striped throat, would live almost beyond my sight, almost beyond belief, but for its double note. Among high leaves, a leaf, at ease, at home, in air and light. and I, through woods and fields, through fallen days, am passing to where I belong, at home, at ease, and well. In Sabbaths of this place, almost invisible, toward which I go from song to song. So the big welcome of even what you don't know yet, of what and where you belong, of what and where you are. So the big welcome of what already you know, of everything that you know of you, and also what you don't. I love, one of the things I love in the poem is the frog there, invisible because of it being in its given place, feeling the givenness and the having of a place that's been given always. And then invisible in its given place, invisible because of being well. And it feels like there's that, the wellness of the place and of the frog, that is the invisibility. If the place were out of harmony, it wouldn't have that same seamlessness with the frog. And so feeling that wellness within and without, that we can barely feel. And so the practice of feeling what we can barely feel, sometimes a struggle and sometimes so easy, effortless. Is there any question or anything to share or say?
I just wanted to add something to the story.
Yeah.
In the case of San Virgo, it was a very hot day when I was a child.
Mm.
In the field, and in the sun, and I just went to rest in the shade.
Mm.
It's the simplicity of a child going to rest in the shade on a hot day.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you. And that the coolness. We can start to recover our ability to sense when we're attracted towards getting all heated up. And visible, and we want some visible evidence, and we want someone to notice that we're working so hard or doing so great or so badly or whatever. And then that another kind of movement that's softer and more powerful towards coolness, we can say. Coolness and home. Anyone else? Yes.
I'm just curious. Is
yes.
Your property the same root teacher as me?
Yeah. That's the same part. Anyone else?
The thing I really love about the Buddha, Gautama Buddha, and the suffering is he said it.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I teach one thing and one thing only,
mm-hmm.
suffering and the end of suffering.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's simple.
Could you hear?
No.
Do you want to do it again? Or shall I? Why don't you? No, you don't.
Apparently what the Buddha said was, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering, which sounds like two things, but it's brilliant.
Mm. Yeah. Could you hear now? Yeah. And that's also what I was just trying to say, when we can start to feel ourselves all getting hot and wanting visibility or oriented around visibility. I don't want to be visible, I do, etc. Love, hate, relationship with visibility. Feeling how that hurts, how it doesn't fit, is a help towards finding what does fit. So just noticing when the mind is getting twisted and we're buying into that. We're like, oh, I'm supposed to be doing something that doesn't fit. That's what they must be asking me to do something that doesn't fit. Otherwise, how do we know it's worthwhile? How do we know we're doing something if we can't feel that it doesn't fit? And feeling that it doesn't fit then rather helps us notice this is unnecessary activity that doesn't lead home. By feeling that what hurts, hurts, that's part of what we're recovering, to feel that this hurts. And that we can feel it hurts unnecessarily. So there's going to be pain, but suffering can be that unnecessary hurt on top or underneath. Which one? The whole thing? Okay, sure. So there will be pain, but we can define suffering differently. We can say suffering is the unnecessary pain. That's how there can be an end of suffering. There's not an end of pain. There's going to be pain and pleasure. So Ramana Maharshi had cancer and died of cancer, and there would have been pain, but not suffering. So we kind of have that wish. It's a little bit like as a child, the parents are heroes, and there's that sense that enlightenment's going to take all that bad stuff away. And that's not the thing, that's not the deal. And our that trying to find a deal where someone's going to take all the pain away is the cause of our suffering.
Maybe the deal is to get a different
interpretation. To get a what? Different?
Interpretation.
Yeah, it's a different angle.
Yeah. How do you distinguish between doubt and not fit? Of course, it's a feeling, but I think it's very.
Yeah.
Doubt and fit.
Yeah. I could be interested, when it's not the end of a long day, I'd like to hear a little more detail of your experience of doubt and not fit. But for now, maybe we can say just getting to know that feeling where there is so what I'm calling ventilation, breeziness, not an unnecessary boundary, not an unnecessary sense of separation. Because doubt can be also helpful. But I think what you mean is that doubt that's not helpful. We can get a feeling of even a really good question. We might start to question something. The question itself is good, but the mode of questioning, the energy of questioning, is heavy and claustrophobic. And it's a program going on. It's a reaction. It's out of fear. And so sometimes I'd recommend to people to actually write down the question and then wait until you that kind of heavy, twisting mood has come apart. And then let's go back to the question. Like, for example, what are we doing here? Why meditate? What is meditation? Those are all really good questions. But if it's being asked, like hammering myself on the head or something, I'm not really asking the question. I'm hammering myself on the head. And then let's go back to the question when we just feel really open to find out. If there's something to find out, let's find out. What are we doing here? What is meditation? Why? Is there an answer? So it's by letting it be messy and often mixed. Sometimes it's doubt and not fit together. And we kind of feel that it's both, and so we get stuck. And sort of that giving space for that kind of struggle, that kind of friction, something can kind of, we have a shift of perspective and we see both. Where I was sort of guiding myself by an idea and not my experience, and what I could do differently, that I'd never realized I could just simply do it differently. Another part of that is doubt. We would more likely believe and get pulled into it. And not fit, we would more likely keep putting it away, like, don't bother me, I'm just trying to meditate here. And we would keep ignoring the not fit of the way we think we're supposed to meditate, instead of listening to ourselves deeply, like, so what's not fitting in this way of meditation? What is my assumption about meditation that's not fitting? And then we get that really helpful doubt. And so another way to say that is that not fitting is an experience that's fine with there not being a right and a wrong. And the doubt that eats away at us is sure there's somehow, big or small, secret or open, there's a right and a wrong. And so I'm not saying like politically or in big outer situations that there's not right and wrong. That I'm not getting there right now. I'm just talking about in our inner experience, how often the belief that there is a right and a wrong way, and measuring myself against that, measuring others against that as a main occupation, how that eats up our life. And so a practice of noticing that there is the right and wrong squeezing, twisting, not allowing us to even have any contact with ourselves to find out what this is. So let's get in touch and find out what it is experientially. We might not be able to describe it, but experientially, a little taste of what's going on. And then let's do that for some time, and then maybe we can talk about what's a good way of living and treating each other and ourselves. Okay, so I'd like to offer that anyone, especially if you are traveling today, if you're really tired, feel free to go to bed. And anyone who'd like to stay for a half an hour meditation with short instructions, feel free to stay. Is there a need for a bathroom break, or can we go straight into the meditation? It's okay? What about being open to let the body find more ease? Just being more allowed to be here as it is and less trying to meditate. An open body. Can feel all around the body, the air and the ground, the clothing. The air also within the body. The waves of movement of breathing, passing through the tissues. just for a while, letting the body be still and at peace here. No demand. And feeling how even in stillness there's movement, so it's not a, it's not the idea. It's a kind of quality of stillness. Of landing in our given place. Continually just coming back inside the body when we find ourselves relating to an image or memory. So undoing the memory and leaving it free. Knowing image of body as just an image in the mind rather than actually anything to do with the body itself. And so direct experience of the body. A flash of warm, a flash of cool, a tiny moment of feeling a movement, a tiny moment of feeling heaviness, or a texture, or lightness. Lots of flashes of sensation and lots of space between the flashes. And with the help of the music that just started playing, we can play with letting that be and noticing if the attention goes there and we're just kind of leaning out towards that sound. We have the chance of shifting back, feeling the back of the body shifting down to the ground and feeling just like there's that sound there and there's those thoughts. There's also the sensation of contact with the ground, or feeling the feet, the back of the body, the lower belly, or the breath, or some combination of those. And just continually kind of resting back and being surprised that here again, here again. The warmth of the belly, even though there's thinking and sound also happening. And how restfully can we let sounds go on, thinking go on, but still staying true to a kind of really fine thread of that experience just now in lower belly or wherever. Wherever feels closer to home for you. Easier to come so intimately inside, to leave the images and memories as just movements of mind, like the movements of the leaves of the trees. Just another kind of life movement. Continually playing with doing less. how little effort is needed. Just leaving room for this fresh, surprising experience. Of lower belly or your chosen spot. And we're not fighting against sound and attention hearing. We can keep restfully noticing there's still belly. Feeling where in the mind there might be a feeling of a problem or an excitement. And then just unmaking the problem, unmaking the excitement, and resting with what is.